Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we are going to explore archetypal forms and forces. With me is Dr. Angelus Arian, a cross-cultural anthropologist, a gifted storyteller, corporate consultant, trainer, professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies and also at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Menlo Park, California, and author of a number of books, including The Tarot Handbook, Signs of Life, and The Fourfold Way, Walking the Paths of the Healer, Visionary, Teacher, and Warrior. Welcome, Angelus.
Hi, Jeffrey.
It's a pleasure to be
yes,
with you.
It's wonderful to be here. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Archetypes are such magical energies. It seems as if they're always there, just beckoning us to rise out above the littleness of our day-to-day lives and discover the beauty of every moment, the gift that each moment offers to us to enter into adventure or wonder or to share something heartfelt and healing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been your path looking at these energies as they manifest in cultures all over the planet.
Yeah, it's been really wonderful to think about the forces that work human beings, regardless of their cultural conditioning or their family imprinting, often think about what are those forces. And that's what led me into really taking a look at cross-culturally, are we worked by the same forces? And
mm-hmm.
I'm touched by in the Appalachian Mountains when they greet you, they say, what's learning ya? What's working ya? And I think about, well, what are the forces that are working us and are learning us? And basically, I think there are really three. They're actually the healing forces and the initiatory forces and the creative forces that hold or make a huge basket or cauldron or container that come many templates or what mm-hmm. Jung called the archetypes. And
yeah.
And so that motivated me to take a look at, well, are there ways that we move as a human spirit towards wholeness? And that's where the indigenous peoples of the world often work with the way of the warrior, which warrior is an old-fashioned term for leadership, or the way of the teacher, because every culture of the world has some educational method, and the way of the healer. All cultures of the world have healing models, and or the way of the visionary, where all the creative arts bubble out of, because human beings want to always express their vision. So
these archetypal, you could think of them as role models, but they're more like alive energies are there beckoning with inside of each of us.
Yes, I think so, and I think that in many ways our life dream or our life calling is ignited, or we have a tendency to remember why we're here and what is it that we're really here to do as human beings. And I think in many ways we're here to really learn about love and express love, and we're really here to create, and our life dream is really anchored in intimacy, and those forces percolate there in many ways, just waiting to see which one they can seize next.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like being seized by the muses. Mm-hmm. And I often think about the nine muses in Greek mythology, and how in many ways, even though they were all feminine in form, they were gate openers to the mysteries of these archetypes, or in many ways would beckon us to music or science or to the arts or mm-hmm. a particular way that we might be called. I think it's interesting for people to reflect, or the audience maybe to reflect, if they had, what ways have they really explored? Have they explored leadership, the way of the warrior? Have they explored healing modalities or medicine? Or have they explored the wisdom ways, which is the way of the teacher? Or the creative fire, which is really found in all the arts globally?
You suggest that if we leave these potentials within us unexplored, they become latent in ways that sort of provoke us, and sometimes that provocation might manifest as a depression or mm-hmm. as an anxiety, yeah, that we're out of sorts with our lives. We may not know why, but it might be the healer yearning to be born.
Yes, it's I often think about what Jung said some time ago, when he said that the psychological mechanism for transforming energy is the symbol. And I think in our dream life, we get those nudges from the psyche, and we can be standing in the shower, and the psyche is thinking, oh good, now they're available for some information to come through, or we're driving along on the freeway. I think consciousness is really about, if I'm not here, but I've parked my body. Let's say that you're here and you have the vacancy sign mm-hmm. on. Consciousness would be about really tracking where I am if I'm not here. And I think that the psyche is always giving us information. It never gives us more than we need or less than we need, but it's mm-hmm. always nudging us. It's like the invisible ox herding poke that is there. And I think a lot of depression is a lot of creativity, a lot of information that has come through intuitively or through guidance or through dreams that hasn't been acted upon.
Mm-hmm.
And
people can go for years and years without awakening those slumbering archetypes.
Yeah, it's amazing. I know the Nobel Prize winner of literature, Juan Ramon Jimenez, in his 40s was really depressed and felt that he was unconnected to his creative fire, and that everything had lost meaning for him. And so he decided that maybe he should go to the mountains. And so he went to the mountains, the Pyrenees Mountains, for 3 months, and came back mm-hmm. from the mountains and wrote this poem as a way of really staying connected to the creative fire and connected to what had meaning for him, and a reminder of who he really was rather than who he thought he was. And I think it captures how a man was really seized by an archetype. And I think the archetype of healing and the archetype of the visionary, when he wrote, I am not I. I am the one who walks beside me that I cannot see, and the one whom at times I manage to visit, and the one whom at times I forget, and the one who remains calm and silent as I talk, and the one who forgives gently as I move into anger or fear or doubt, and the one who walks where I cannot go, and the one who remains standing when I die. And I guess the question I had after reading that was, there was a man who had walked into the garden of the archetypes, a deep remembering of who he really mm-hmm. was, that restored meaning to his life again and also reconnected him to the creative fire. And I think when the archetypes are ways that ignite us back home to the soul's path and reopen or reawaken the heart. And I think from there, then we can really create collectively and individually together mm-hmm. and begin to bring our medicine, our original medicine, to the earth
that
and to our families.
That first line was striking. I am not I.
Yeah.
It's as if, in some sense, there's an alienation from our own potentials. And
yeah.
in another sense, the poem seems to be welcoming all of that back.
Yeah, it's true. It's mm-hmm. really true. Rumi, the 12th century poet, I was looking at this beautiful rug that you have here on the floor, and I was thinking about it being like a magic carpet, and just the whole motif of the magic carpet is I think that archetypes take us back to wonder and awe and curiosity and to the instinctual magic that's within. And I love that the Egyptian hieroglyphs, that the Egyptian hieroglyph for magic, literally, when you take it apart, is the art of communication. And Rumi, the 6th century poet, used to love to sit on one of these old, like Turkish rugs, and sit there as he would write a poem to remember that we must move from within. Don't move the way fear wants you to. Begin a foolish project. Noah did. And I think what's really interesting is that if we can get back home, we can start moving from within and beginning to disengage the inhibitors to love and creativity, which are found in fear and pride, mm-hmm. and move, don't move the way fear wants you to, and begin a foolish project, our life dream or mm-hmm. a heart song. Noah did. I love that. Noah did. And so I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, in many ways with the research that you contributed and really the pioneering work that you did with parapsychology and the work of intuition, you really went home to a very deep place in honoring the mystery and the intuitive and the transpersonal. And I think that with the 21st century, the call is really to go home so that we can redream our lives again and to redream the earth mm-hmm. again, in a way.
Yeah. Alan Watts wrote a book that had a funny title. It was called The Book.
Uh-huh.
And the subtitle
right.
was something about the book
right.
about the conspiracy against knowing who you are.
Uh-huh.
And since you remind me of my own path in parapsychology and intuition, it's striking to me that there was something like a social conspiracy to keep this wisdom, this knowledge, away from the mainstream. Now that's mm-hmm. changing
yes.
very, very rapidly cool. these days, but I think for many people there is still a kind of subtle pressure to remain in locked into the smallness mm-hmm. of who we conceive ourselves mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to be, not to be aware of these archetypal energies and potentials and promises within us, but to think of ourselves as the worker or the person who has a dreary life
yeah.
or something like that.
Yeah, it's so limited.
Mm-hmm.
It's a limited view of the magnificent, wondrous, multifaceted creatures that we are, and the power of the human spirit. I really feel that there's such a heart sickness or a soul loss that's taking place because mm-hmm. people won't stand behind their gifts and talents.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost like a collective consensus trance to stand more behind a self-diminishment and insufficiency rather than, as indigenous people say, stand in your long, tall body with your deep roots, and your long, tall body with your deep roots, which is getting back to kind of the inherent largesse that's there in all of us that has nothing to do with inflation or arrogance or diminishment or insufficiency. I love that in the wintertime, many indigenous peoples of the world will bury a knife as a reminder that I will not be the one who will cut away at my own nature. And I think we have to give up kind of that addiction of self-depreciation. And begin to move behind more of the innate gifts and talents that we carry.
In our culture, people often, when they reach a certain age, they stop dancing.
Yeah, it's really interesting when, if you would go to a shaman or a medicine person or a healer in many different cultures, they would ask you one of four questions. They'd say, when in your life did you stop singing? When did you stop dancing? When did you stop being enchanted by stories, and particularly your own life story? And when did you stop being comforted or comfortable with the sweet territory of silence? And so I think that it's very interesting looking cross-culturally that there's not a culture in the world that doesn't sing or dance or tell stories or doesn't realize that silence or solitude is really connected to the mystery. Mm-hmm. And so in the fourfold way educational program that I mentioned also in the fourfold way book is that I want to really ask people, when did you stop singing? Because wherever we stop singing, oceanic peoples of the world say, well, if you can sing, you can tell the truth. Native Americans have said for centuries, well, sing for your life. And recent research shows that that the sound of our own voice chanting or singing strengthens the immune system. Mm-hmm. But Native Americans have known that for centuries because they say, sing for your life. And Africans say, if you can walk, you can dance. And if you can talk, you can sing. Mm-hmm. So I think that music is such a unifying force. Yeah. And we see that in the world today. And I think dancing reconnects people to the body wisdom. I think wherever mm-hmm. anyone has stopped dancing, they've become self-conscious in their body and have lost touch with mm-hmm. innate body wisdom.
There. So when we're talking about the archetypes, it's not just some sort of abstract idea in dusty old Jungian psychology books. It's something we can embody.
Absolutely.
We can dance the archetypes. Yeah. We can sing the archetypes.
Yeah. Or they dance you, or
yes.
they sing you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's really true. It's really true. It's such a mystery, you know. I think that many indigenous peoples often say or believe that our ancestors stand behind us, that our male ancestors stand behind us on the right and our female ancestors stand behind us on the left. And they really say, oh, well, maybe this one will be the one that will bring forward the good, true, and beautiful. Oh, maybe this one will be the one that will break the harmful family patterns or the harmful cultural patterns. Oh, maybe this one will be the one. And I often think about if the archetypes were standing behind us or around us, they say, oh, maybe this one will be the one mm-hmm. that will bring forward the good, true, and beautiful aspect of this life force energy. Or maybe this one will be the one that will break the harmful uses of this energy, mm-hmm. The harmful family patterns or the harmful cultural patterns. So
every one of us has the opportunity to perform that inner alchemy and to heal the past.
Yeah, it's
no matter
so true.
What our circumstances.
Yeah, it's so true. Yeah, it's really. such a rich opportunity.
You tell a wonderful story about the Nubian woman, which is a healing story.
Yes, it really is. It's a wonderful story that comes out of Africa. It's an old Lawrence Vanderpost story from his collection on the Tales of the Bush, and it's a really wonderful story about the connection between spiritual work and the healing energies or forces. And it's about a beautiful black Nubian woman who was wrapped in a red toga with a basket upon her head. And as she walked through the village, she would pass her sisters. And she wondered, whenever she passed, why they would always whisper. Because when she passed, they would go, pss, 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 pss. But she, being of great dignity and grace, would go on through the village and tend to her chores. And all of the women wore these beautiful jujube necklaces, but hers she had fashioned in such a beautiful way that all the sisters, her sisters and comrades in the village, were very jealous and decided that one day they would get that necklace from her. And on Fridays, all the women would do washing down at the riverbed. And so she decided that she would join them on Friday morning. And they were already in the water. And she thought, well, maybe today they would include her and not whisper. And sure enough, they said, oh, won't you come into the river with us? Won't you come into the river with us? And she thought, oh, what a great day. This is the day. This is the day that once again I'm included. And so she went into the river with them, and she noticed that they didn't have their necklaces on. And she said, well, what have you done with your necklaces? And they said, well, we did a very important ritual this morning. What we did this morning is that we decided to throw our necklaces as an offering to the gods and the goddesses of the river. And the black Nubian woman, she was so touched. She said, what a wonderful thing. What a wonderful thing to do. And she said, oh, I would like to do that too. And so she took her necklace and she closed her eyes and made a prayer, and she threw the necklace into the river. And at that moment, then all the women turned upon her and they splashed her and they said, oh, do you think we would be so stupid as to give our necklaces to the gods and the gods of the river? Do you think we would be so stupid? And they went to the side of the riverbank and they pulled out the necklaces and washed them, put them back on, and splashed her again, and were so thrilled with their coup that they put all their clothing back in that had been drying into the baskets and went up to the village. And the Nubian woman went to the side of the bank and she sat there and she wept and she wept and she wept. And then she stood up and she wrapped herself in the toga and put the basket back on top of her head. And then she went along the side of the riverbank and she began to pray to the gods and the goddesses of the river. And she prayed that they return the necklace to her. And she wept and she prayed. And then she thought she heard something. But no, must have just been the gurgles of the river. But no, she heard it again. Plunge in. Plunge in. And she plunged down into the riverbed. And there, when the mud began to clear about 12 feet away from her, there was this old woman covered with all these oozing sores saying, lick my sores. Lick my sores. And being the woman that she was, she crawled to the old woman and took her hand and very slowly began to lick one of the sores. And as she licked that sore, a very strange thing happened. All the sores on her body closed, and her face became very radiant and luminescent.
Mm-hmm. We may not have time for the whole story. but this part of it is really special.
Yeah. Well, it is, because it's a reminder that when we have been betrayed, and all betrayal is a result of self-deception, because she was unwilling to take action on what she had really noticed. She had noticed the whispers.
The whispering, yeah.
And so why would she think that anything would be different that morning when they included her in? And when we have been wounded or betrayed, then it's often then that we will go home. And then she began to pray. And then she thought she heard something. Oh, it was just the gurgles of the river. But no, she heard it again. And it was the wisdom voice saying, plunge in. And she went home to her own riverbed, to the core. And always when we go home to our own riverbed, they're sitting there as the wise person within, giving us our next instructions for our healing. Now that you've come home, now that you're here, lick my sores.
And she was able to do that, what many people might think of as a very repulsive sort of thing. And that's it, being willing to confront your own
woundedness,
humiliation, your own queasiness about things takes us into the archetypal realm.
Yeah, it really does. And storytelling is such a, and poetry is a way of igniting the mythic imagination, but it also ignites the archetypes. It's a way of really putting us home in the mystery and letting
Angelus Arian. I'm going to interrupt you here because we're out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry, I get so wound up.
It's been such a joy.
Thank you for being with me. Thank you very much. Thank you, Jeffrey, for your good work. Thanks.
Thank you for being with us, and check your listings for part two of this program on the forms and forces of archetypes. We'll be back.